let's go through the five stars, five questions, and discuss in a little bit more
sure.
detail. So I'll read the questions, and then you can just discuss some of this material.
Sure.
Is there erotic polarity, a spark of attraction between me and another person?
Well, and this is I first encountered this with David Data. You know, my entry into Integral was essentially through Data.
Yeah.
You know, I took some of his teaching, and I thought, God, here's somebody that I finally respect around and can agree with around sexuality. Whenever there's a connection between us and something else or someone else, there's an energetic connection, and that's a polarity. And if it's a connection between a masculine and a feminine, more masculine or feminine source, that tends to be an erotic polarity. And if it's a positive one, it's a spark of attraction. And it doesn't have to be positive. I mean, sometimes, you know, there'll be you'll find somebody and you just don't like them. You know, there's an energetic polarity, but that's a negative one. And so that little spark, that spark between the masculine and feminine, say my masculine, because I'm a masculine person and someone's feminine, there's a little spark of polarity. I've found in relationships that there needs to be at least some connection, some erotic polarity for at least a lover relationship, a marriage relationship, to have the ability. And mostly in this culture, we're taught to dissociate away from erotic polarity, to not notice it, which causes disastrous problems. This is a manuscript that I talked to you about several years ago. I still haven't published it, called 100 Reasons to Not Have a Secret Affair. And I had to work to keep it to 100. I really had to combine some things. Because since we're not aware of erotic polarities, they tend to sneak up on us. And when they show up, unannounced, so to speak, and without the capacity for us to normalize them and understand them, sometimes dangerous things, sometimes great things can happen. And so I wanted people to begin to make those energetic polarities, particularly erotic polarities, one, objects of awareness, and two, something that we normalize. And so if I pass, an attractive woman and there's an energetic exchange, if I'm aware of the energy, I can adjust my energy so that it serves the highest good, so that she feels attractive rather than intruded upon. And if she's walking down the street and she's generating an erotic light and she gets a certain kind of attention from guys, she's not giving so much light that it's an invitation, but there's enough light so that she feels enlivened and they feel enlivened.
Right.
And so that comes from awareness. And that awareness comes from observing, is there erotic polarity, a spark of attraction between me and this other person?
Right. Well, and that's the whole spectrum of energy, particularly focused in the upper right, mm-hmm. the exterior of the individual, the objective domain, and that runs from gross to subtle to causal energies. Erotic, sexual energy is already subtle energy.
Yep.
It's already prana. And so that's a really centrally and crucially important energy in a human being. And evolution, of course, started out with very little of that. I mean, the first cells divided asexually. And then and those cells, of course, could end up theoretically living forever, because they reproduce by just biting off or dividing, and this same cell just sort of went on and went on and went on until it got hit or crunched or run over by a truck or something. And when sex was introduced, death was introduced. And so we have this strange inner twinkling of Eros and Thanatos. And so Freud himself eventually went through three phases of what instincts were, and he ended up with Eros and Thanatos. This is very interesting, but it's certainly a crucial polarity in humans as well. And so if a relationship is going to click, if it's going to mesh, then that's certainly a dimension that has to mesh in. And even though, again, people, as you said, sometimes not very well aware of it, in several cases, it's sort of all people focus on. Again, it's the primary fantasy, and it's a erotic attraction. And the point is not that we should get rid of that. even though, as you and research tends to point out, an intimate relationship can be driven by primarily erotic energy from only around 6 to 18 months.
Yeah.
And then it tends to fade. And so then you better have something else lined up, or that relationship is not going to go anywhere. So the point is not to sort of ignore that or to not include that in the equation, but it's to also be aware of these other dimensions and these other quadrants, these other stars, and make sure that you're also asking questions that cover those. So one that covers both upper right and upper left is question two: does this person maintain their physical upper right and psychological upper left health? And you found that to be centrally important.
I absolutely do. And, you know, we have opinions. There was one of my favorite studies is people were introduced to someone and just spent a few seconds with them, really. And then people were introduced to someone and had regular contact with them for 5 weeks, and then they were asked questions about this other person. And they had basically about the same amount of understanding about the other person.
Right, same amount of accuracy.
Yeah, same amount of accuracy. So, and so, you know, physical and psychological health, people don't have to be buff, and they don't have to be, you know, super Dalai Lama balanced. They just need to seem interested in staying reasonably healthy and happy and willing to put regular effort into it. And that's especially true about what people do when they shift. This whole idea that we manage processes our whole life, interior processes and relational processes, and that those processes are in response to life circumstances shift towards more or less healthy naturally, and that a healthy person isn't someone that is healthy all the time. It's this person who feels themselves shifting towards ill health in an area and then shifts back. And you feel that shift, and you can perceive that shift in all quadrants, in all four quadrants. And then if you're aware of it, then you get information from the lower right in terms of what are the norms of healthy behavior, the upper right in terms of, you know, what's the individual characteristics, and upper left in terms of the subjective experience of health, and the lower left in terms of how does health show up intersubjectively.
Right.
There's one thing that I'm a scientist. I just love science, and I love right quadrant stuff, and it's fun to take the right quadrant stuff and put it together with all the left quadrant stuff.
Right.
Left quadrant stuff too. There's an awful lot of data that really guides us about what's healthy and not healthy, and it's really good to know that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, diet, exercise, sleep, you know, stuff that we all take for granted were controversial in the 70s. I can't, you know, people used to tease me about eating organic and we're exercising all the time in the 70s. You're a health nut.
Yeah.
I said, no, I want to live a long time.
Right.
And science will bear me out. And by God, I told you so to all those people that are still alive and said that to me.
Right. Well, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the great sort of pleasures of having an integrally informed view of things is being able to line up data in all of the various dimensions and see how they reinforce each other. So, star three.
Yeah.
If I was in relationship with this person and there was conflict, would he or she be able and willing to do what it takes to get back to love?
That's a big one. I mean, they're all big. You know, it's funny. I remember when you did Cosmic Consciousness, every time that you got to a new part of Aqua, you'd make some comment about, I think this is my favorite part. You know? And then you went from states. Yeah, states are my favorite part. Types are my favorite part. No, but I feel that way about these things. The ability to get back to love through conflict probably is the one central ability that determines whether you're going to be a happy guy or not in your life. I mean, because the number one characteristic associated with health, with happiness, in the Chicago study that's done every year, there's five things associated with happiness. They ask about happiness, and the first one is always intimate relationships. And intimate relationships work when people can adjust from conflict back to love.
Right.
John Gottman, in his work, he's the best couples researcher probably on the planet. Basically, he found that people that had escalating conflict tended to divorce early and be miserable. And
right.
and people who weren't able to up-level positive, to up-regulate positive contact, they tended to divorce late. And getting back to love kind of hits both those things because, you know, love is positive. Love is pleasurable.
Right.
So you're not just getting from conflict to neutral. You're getting from conflict to love. And so there's a lot of things associated with that. You need to know what a defensive state is. As you said, most people don't know about this. I am staggered that, again and again, I'll go to different environments, and people don't have a really clear understanding of how human beings enter defensive states when they feel a subjective sense of threat, and how when they're in socially engaged states, they do much better. These are almost like meta states in terms of how we relate to each other. And so you need to know what a defensive state is, and you need to be able to catch it in yourself and have ways of regulating back to social engagement and then eventually with another person back to love. There's just so many. I mean, there's so many ways to do it. There are some universals, like, for instance, focusing on what's valid about your other person's problems, focusing on feeling where violence arises, violence of emotion, violence of thought, violence of expression, and regulating that to nonviolence, understanding your own developmental history, your trauma history, the areas where there's unprocessed, implicit programming that causes you to be hypersensitive. It's very, very complicated. But the bottom line is if you're committed to noticing when conflict's happening and then being able and willing. So able is having the skills. Willing means having the resolve to get back to love. And you have a partner who does that. Then you harness this human superpower. I think humans have this superpower, and that's focus, intent. You focus, intent, and action in service of principle, and driven by resolve. Okay, focus, intent, and action in service of principle and driven by resolve. If you're willing and able to use those human superpowers to get back to love, you're going to do well. And that's the third star.
So how can you tell this from interacting with the individual? What should a person look for to tell if somebody's going to be able to do that?
Well, first of all, you just need to be with somebody for a period of time. You know, romantic infatuation generates an awful lot of dopamine and testosterone in your brain.
Right.
Okay, well, dopamine is the pleasure seeker neurotransmitter and testosterone is the sexual neuromodulator, and so you tend to feel pretty sexy and pretty great, and you're basically medicated for 6 to 18 months, and you don't notice negative things about your partner, but you just don't care about them much. So, you know, it's nice to know that. But in terms of getting to know somebody right away, well, you can ask them, how do they respond to criticism? You can ask them, someone says, well, people don't criticize me much, or, you know, I respond really well, and so you criticize them to see how they respond. You ask them how their relationships have gone. People that have difficulty getting back to love will have relationships that ended in conflict often. In fact, when I'm doing an intake, one of my stock questions is, what were your longest relationships and how did they end? And if routinely people says, yeah, she was just awful and he was just horrible and I had to leave him, or, you know, if there's a repetitive pattern of identifying somebody as bad or impaired and so on, and then I was victimized in some fashion, or even misunderstood in some fashion, that's not a good sign. Now, that doesn't mean you don't go out with the person again. What that means is you say, well, you know, it's not a good sign that your last two relationships ended with your partner cheating on you, or even worse, you cheating on your partner, and then you leaving without being able to resolve it. I mean, how did that happen? Now, someone who's able and willing to get back to love, actually will be able to have that conversation more easily and be self-reflective in an evaluative fashion, being able to see their strengths and weaknesses.
Right.
Someone who is less able to get back to love will become defensive in that conversation.
Right.
If you're gonna discover somebody's defensiveness, you really want to discover it the first couple of dates. You know, erotic, lust and erotic and romantic infatuation gather momentum quite fast.
Right.
The easiest time to interrupt a destructive love affair is after the first really hard glance.
Right.
That's the easiest time. I mean, you can interrupt it at any point, but it just gets harder.
Yeah, yeah.
So those are ways that you can find out.
Okay.
And mostly the conversation, just having the conversation. Well, if we were in conflict, would you be willing to go to a therapist with me? Now, if a person says, absolutely not, I would never go to a therapist, to me, that's a no-brainer. I advise people, if someone says they would never, ever go to a therapist, probably you're not going to have a successful relationship with them. You
right.
would not need to go to a therapist with them. But, that kind of rigid standard is a really bad sign.
Right.
I mean, one of the worst signs, for instance, of the Bush White House is they were all contemptuous of therapy.
Yeah.
systemically contemptuous of self-reflection and therapy. Bad things are going to happen in a system like that.
A lot of fundamentalist religious believers are anti-therapeutic. They think it means that you're not right with Christ.
Yeah, well, that's a problem.
Yeah, it is.
Christ was the original therapist. Talk about unconditional positive regard and helping people transform and encouraging people to love each other.
Right.
He's kind of the role model for all of it.
Indeed. Star 4, how does this person show up as a parent or family member?
When I said this to my daughter, I forget how old she was, 15 or 14, 15, something like that. She says, why should I care about that? I don't want to have kids with a guy. I just want to date him. I said, good point, Zoe. Excellent point. But someone that doesn't show up appropriately, and I'm not talking about codependence, where you give to people when actually you should be setting boundaries. I'm talking about appropriately. Somebody that doesn't show up appropriately in a parental role, for instance, won't appropriately put their needs second to a child's needs. That person is going to have narcissistic wounds that will make them problematic in an intimate relationship.
Right.
Someone who needs to set a boundary or needs to attend to a family member in a healthy way and refuses to. That particular form of egocentricism is going to cause a problem in an intimate relationship, whether there's kids and family involved or not. And so it's an important dimension. And it's also a dimension that tends to grow. Now, I was very lucky when I met Becky, my wife. She and I have been together 41 years. I could care less whether my lovers were good parents or not when I was in my late teens and early 20s. Becky, as it turns out, is a naturally great parent. I became enormously grateful for that 12 years later when we started having children. Didn't realize how important it was going to be to me. There's another variable also in modern society, maybe not as much as in the 50s. Anybody that you're a lover with, there's a possibility that you're going to share a child with that person. If you're younger, if it's a younger woman, she might get pregnant. If people are older and they have kids, you might be in a parental role, or they might be in a parental role with your kids. And it will really, really matter how they show up as a parent. And if you have any kind of relationship with your family that's either positive or negative, you want your partner to be able to support you in how you deal with that. And if they don't show up as a family member, they won't be able to do that, and you won't be able to do it with them if you can't show up.
Right.
So these are critical variables that aren't considered very much but turn out to be very important as people become involved.
Right.
And if you're involved and you have kids and you realize somebody doesn't show up as a parent or family member, which a lot of my clients have, I can think of several people right now who they married guys that these are women that were good parents who married guys who were crappy parents. And now, they're divorced, of course, and they come in amazed at what an awful parent this guy is. I have a couple of cases where the woman is an awful parent. In fact, one specific one, the woman has personality disorder and is frankly abusive.
Right.
Well, these people here's these kids they care about more than anything else in the world who spend half their time with some crazy person who doesn't treat them very well.
Right.
It's a nightmare for those people.
Right.
And so we should have entered in the culture. I mean, you hear my, this is Keith's, I'm hoping, healthy green saying should. We should have a standard in this culture that we show up as parents and family members, and it should matter to me and a potential lover whether they do. And it should matter to a potential lover whether I do.
Right. Well, and it's indicative of how a person, their fundamental meshing with the lower quadrants, with the relationship dimensions of being. And, of course, you know, for integral theory, those are, it's not that there's an individual person and that they may or may not be in a inter-subjective or inter-objective relationship. It's that those all arise together and they all exist together. And so you're really, if you're not in a capacity to be able and willing and open to both healing those relationships if they fracture and setting aside your own narcissistic desires to step into a more parental or familial role, then you're fundamentally not in a healthy relationship with those dimensions of your being.
Yep.
And so whether you're an actual parent or not, if you can't be a parent, then you're going to have problems with that dimension because it's just not fitting. It's not meshing well. And so you're running up against reality in a nasty and dysfunctional way, and it will show up someplace. So it seems really crucial to me, and it is strange that it doesn't get more emphasis on sort of clinical intake areas.
Yeah, the family therapist, the family systems movement of the second part of the 20th century was those people really emphasized the lower left and the lower right. Gregory Bateson, Virginia Satir, Jay Haley, Murray Bowen, and those guys. I love those guys. I taught family systems at the Santa Barbara Graduate Institute. And it was a good foundation for people who were learning how to be therapists, because those are the people that first started relating to relationships being the core of everything.
Right.
And started examining them from all four quadrants.
Yeah.
And those humanists, you know, God bless them, you know, a lot of them were coming from integral altitudes a lot of the time.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, star five. Does this person have deep soul's purpose, and would they appreciate what's meaningful for me?
Human beings, you know, you and I share this utter fascination and admiration for self-aware human consciousness. And so what does it mean to be a human being? Well, unobstructed human beings search for the emotional experience of meaningful activity. I mean, on a tiny level, we want flow states. Thich Nhat demonstrated that in his work.
Right.
But on a deeper level, we want our lives to mean something. We want a purpose. And we seek it, and you know, as Don Juan said to Carlos Castaneda in the teachings of Don Juan, you want a path with a heart. And when we have one, we're happier people. And that's been proved, or not proved, but supported by research. And when we don't have one, we suffer. And not only that, if I have a path with the heart, I need to feel supported by my intimate others in my path with the heart, in what's sacred to me. If I feel their indifference, or even worse, their contempt or dismissal of what's sacred to me, that's going to poison our relationship.
Right.
Contempt in general is the great relationship poison, but it's particularly nasty when it comes to deep purpose. And if my partner has something that's sacred to him or her, I don't need to share her mission. I don't need to share what's sacred to her. You know, Becky's and my spiritual paths are different, but I admire her spiritual path deeply and respect it, and so does she with me. We've done different practices and had different teachers and some similarities for 41 years. If she didn't feel her spirituality or spiritual path, what was sacred to her? And sometimes it's not spirituality. Sometimes it's work. Sometimes it's an activity. Sometimes it's service. Sometimes it's sports. You know, I have a guy that I work with where he finds deep meaning in golf. And, you know, Michael Murphy obviously found deep meaning in golf and wrote a book about it. Still talks about it. You know, he kind of teases himself about it in interviews that it was so important to him. But it was important to him.
Right.
It was a path with a heart. And so I want to be able to pursue my path with a heart and know that I need one and honor it in myself and seek one if I don't have one. And I need my partner to respect that and to feel that in me and even admire it. And my partner needs that from me. And so that shared understanding, often couples won't talk about it with each other, but you can tell when they have it. Someone
right.
brings up what's sacred to them. And, you know, when the other person gets pissed off or distressed or whatever, they don't attack them in that sacred area.
Right.
You know, it's kind of a zone. It stays sacred. You know, and couples that have that kind of mutual understanding and mutual respect do so much better, Ken.
Right.
And if an individual has something deeply meaningful that they feel the other person dismisses, that's just a disaster.
Right.
And it has to change. And, you know, I'll tell somebody, you know, if you can't develop a sense of appreciation and respect for what's sacred to her or what's sacred to him, you're going to lose him. You're going to lose her. And so, you know, what is it in you that resists seeing the significance of that? And so that, you know, that's led into to lots of intense sessions
right.
over the last 41 years.
Right.
And it's a big deal.
So, as you say, basically, people both choose better partners and are better partners when they're observing all of these central dimensions.
Yeah.
And so that's rather the point of that. So you have in the course 100 exercises set out. And as you say, quote, each of which fits into the larger picture, but also stands on its own if you just want to know about growth mindsets. So people can do as much or as little of this as they want.
Yeah.
Very cool. A quick issue that is occasionally brought up, many relationship courses are taught by couples. They claim it's important that they include both masculine and feminine perspectives. So how do you address women and men as they feel heard in these sensitive relationship discussions?
Well, in terms of masculine and feminine perspectives, there's lots of masculine and feminine perspectives. I like what David Data said about this. That pure depth of consciousness is the masculine and everything else is the feminine.
Yeah.
But that being said, you know, this is a cosmology that I wanted to practically transmit, and I couldn't have done it with another person, whether it was a man or a woman. You know, I love teaching with women, and I've done it. I used to do a lot of sex therapy and led groups with women. Patricia Albert and I did a lecture that's posted on my website. In Loving Completely, I wanted we couldn't have done it that way, and I wouldn't have wanted to. I wanted to, mostly because I wanted to transmit this knowledge area, but also because, and David and I talked about this, the way that I've been putting this out in the world is through therapy, which is this intensely intimate engagement between me and an individual and a couple. And we wanted to recapitulate that as much as possible in these 51 modules. I've thought a lot about how people learn stuff and studied a lot of it. And, you know, there's people, you know, Ellen Langer, who did the research with Christopher Alexander on mindfulness, she did some research on mindful learning, what constituted more effective learning. And that's one of the reasons we have 51 relatively short modules. And so I wanted in those modules to have it be as intimate as possible. And so that's why we did that. And, I'd love to teach material with a woman someday. It would be a different class.
Yeah.
And I think that even if I taught it with another man, but I think if I taught it, I'd rather teach it with a woman because I think that some cool stuff would emerge. And someday maybe I'll have that opportunity. You know, when I saw Diane Hamilton at the Integral Living Group, we were hanging out together, and I said, you know, I'd really like to teach it one time. I don't know how she took that, but I'm hoping that she took it and the spirit was offered. So anyway, that's my answer to that.
Okay. And then let me, one more basic question. Obviously, shadow work is important, but of course it can get a little bit heavy as people are dealing with some very, very occasionally ugly and dispiriting items.
Yeah.
So what's the importance of an individual also exploring what they do well? Sort of the whole point of positive psychology,
mm-hmm.
Not only fixing what's broken, but enhancing what's right. Does that shift the process to a more hopeful or optimistic dynamic?
Absolutely. In my opinion, shadows everything we can't perceive, the good
right.
stuff and the bad stuff. You know, beautiful, good, and true, and the ugly, bad, and false.
Right.
So there's constructive shadow. It's called the adaptive unconscious by modern neuroscientists. And that helps us be, constructive shadow helps us be healthier, more connected. And there's destructive shadow that's often part of defensive states, and that interferes. Now, destructive shadow can be turned into constructive shadow, but, you know, we need to dialysize it. You know, we need to metabolize it. And so there's shadow that we haven't seen. That's simple ignorance. So there's a lot of information in Loving Completely that's just to help people know about stuff that exists in the world, for instance, like growth mindsets and fixed mindsets, and how people naturally go into jealousy mode when their partner is being flirted with and so on. And then there's the shadow material we resist knowing, and that's not just negative stuff. I remember once one of my favorite, we were talking about something, or maybe I was listening to you on a call, and someone said, maybe that was it. So what did you notice about the people that have come to the integral community? And you said, the thing that stands out to most is that a lot of people don't realize how beautiful they are. I thought that was so true, and I've seen it in my clients. And so that shadow, people need to be able to find their strengths and their beauty and acknowledge it.
Right.
And so how each of us manages shadow material largely determines how effective we are in intimacy. A couple who can surrender to constructive shadow and transmute destructive shadow into constructive shadow, they're usually one of those great couples.
Yeah.
You know, and Loving Completely, it's designed to help individuals and couples construct those kinds of spiritual relationships. How? Well, this is both positive and negative stuff. You know, a depressed person is going to resist being shown their strengths and beauty. A horribly anxious person is going to resist their power. And so, you know, I want people to find those things, see them, and then integrate them into a larger self, which, of course, is what creates vertical development as well as alchemically transmuting you in your current worldview into a healthier, more full version.
Right.
And, you know, and I won't get into it, but I'm very interested in fractals because fractals are, you know, when there's boundaries in nature that both connect and separate, there's these patterns. Self-replicating, similar patterns, where the pattern of the whole is repeated at different levels, at time scales and size scales. So in complexity theory, that's where novelty arrives. Well, there's a fractal interface between what we know and what we can see and what we can't see, between shadow and light. And how we negotiate that with ourselves and with our partners really determines how our life goes and how our universe is experienced by us. So that's a big deal. There's an energetic dialectic at the fractal edge of light and shadow, the known and unknown. And, you know, and as therapists, we go to that edge. And I go to that edge every day of my life when I'm doing therapy. And out of that edge, try to help people transmute, bring the positive into awareness and own it. Take the negative and transmute it into positive so that you can experience yourself as embodied God, spirit on earth, relating with God, spirit on earth, sitting across from you.
Right.
You know, when we experience ourselves as that, we go into a state of bliss. And those states of bliss, when it happens in relationship, are what creates those great, beautiful relationships that make us cry when we see them.
Right.
And
right.
I want everybody to have those relationships.
Right.
And I want all the children to learn about them. And I want them to learn about them and teach their children about them. And, you know, the world's going to be a lot better when we're able to do that.
So we have 7 sessions, 51 modules, 100 exercises, all focused on Loving Completely. Do you think you succeed?
I don't know. God, I don't know how you feel after you finish. You know, I wrote this book, Integral Mindfulness, where I wanted to teach a lot of this stuff about mindful living and so on. And you know, I finished and went, okay. I mean, you know, I don't know if any artifact is ever going to capture everything you want it to capture. I think this does better than anything I've ever done before in terms.
Okay, that's a good answer.
And so it's my best effort so far, Ken. And I'm hoping, you know, I'm 64, but I got some good years ahead. I'm hoping I'll produce better ones in the years to come.
So if somebody wants to take the course, what should they do?
Well, they should go to Integral Life and sign up and take the course and, you know, and email me. Let me know how you like it.
Excellent. I am delighted that you were able to produce your best effort yet in conjunction with Integral Life, and just delighted to have you part of this. Thank you very much for taking time to discuss this. This is great.
Oh, Ken, talking with you is one of the pleasures of my life, as I've told you before.
Bless you. Okay, my friend, take care, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye.